Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Great to have you all with us for today's show. Before we get into introducing our panel for the day, as I've done for the last couple of weeks, a few announcements. First of all, watch us on Facebook Live. Go to the GPB News Facebook page, and you can see all of us. I think we all look really great today.
A gorgeous group of people.
And we love it when you leave your comments there. You can also, if you're listening to the show, leave your comments for us at PoliticsGPB, our Twitter handle. Finally, as I've mentioned the last few shows, we're going to be in Columbus, Georgia next Thursday night, June 7th, doing the show in front of a live audience. Mayor Teresa Tomlinson, who is a frequent panelist on the show, is our host down there. But we'll have Josh McCoon, Calvin Smyrie, two well-known Georgia political leaders.
And my buddy Chuck Williams.
Chuck Williams, who is
a Columbus Ledger,
top political reporter down there. Truth in advertising, Jim. Unfortunately, you are not going to be able to be in Columbus, and we don't want to. People should get ready to be disappointed.
I have developed a conflict. I have Hamilton tickets.
Yeah. Jim's going to see Hamilton.
Awesome. We're all jealous that haven't seen it yet.
But if you want to come, and I hope you do, just go to gpb.org/community. All the information on where we'll be, and if you register there, it just assures you of a free seat. And by the way, Tom Faust and I are going to have our producer. We're going to have a big announcement about Political Rewind that those of you who are at the live show will hear first before it's on the air on the next day. So that's all there is to that. Jim Galloway.
That's a teaser.
That's a teaser.
All right. You're hearing the voices. Let's introduce the people behind them. You know Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read him on Wednesdays and Sundays in the newspaper. And, of course, he oversees the Political Insider blog at AJC.com, myajc.com.
Right. Good afternoon. I've made it to another Friday.
Yeah, that's right. If you're listening in real time, it's Friday afternoon. So get set for a weekend. Loretta Lepore is our Friday panelist, and we're glad you're back, Loretta. Loretta's a Republican strategist. She was, I've always said Sonny Perdue, Governor Sonny Perdue's communications director, but they called you a press secretary?
I was the press secretary, yes I was.
Okay. Also worked with the Carly Fiorina campaign, co-chaired it here when Carly Fiorina was running for president of the United States. And back on the show, it's been a while, but we're really glad to have you back. Chuck Cook, one of the best known, busiest immigration lawyers in the Southeast. And when it comes to immigration, his expertise, I think, is pretty much unmatched. He's a provocateur, I jokingly said before the show. He's the Michael Avenatti of immigration lawyers.
I'm going to keep the hair, though. It's great to be here.
So we want to start the conversation about immigration, Chuck, because there are any number of items. Suddenly it's risen back up. You know, it comes
for
and
you,
goes.
For you, it's always up for me. But for America, it's up again.
Right. So before we get into specifics, give us your overview of where we stand right now, in terms of how this country is dealing with undocumented immigrants, where we're headed on this front. Just give us a brief overview.
Well, where we are right now is interesting. We have about 10.5 million undocumented immigrants in America. About 80% of them have been here for at least a decade. 65% of them have U.S. citizen-born children. So as a result of both ignoring the problem and promoting the problem over the last 25 years, we sit in a situation today where we have a small but significant part of our workforce doing mostly jobs that American-born folks don't want to do, and we don't know what to do with it. Now, for those of us in the field, this is an easy fix. I mean, illegal immigration really is a problem of the past. It's not a problem of the future. Our borders are pretty darn secure. We're detaining fewer and fewer people coming into the country every single year.
Let me stop you right there for a minute. Am I not correct? Because this is something the Trump administration for a long time have been touting, that the detention of people crossing the border had gone down. But the numbers are going back up again right now, yes?
The last couple of months they went up, right, as they do every spring.
Oh, okay, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
This is a seasonal thing, like a lot of things. People come for work. When school gets sent in other countries, especially in Central America, they come up.
Yeah.
So it's really just kind of an ebb and a flow that you'll see. You'll see it go down again in the fall. But the reality is we're still catching and not releasing, but detaining fewer people than we have since Richard Nixon was president. And that is a demographic issue. That's about demography. You no longer see Mexicans coming to the United States in any significant numbers because the population growth of Mexico has slowed to below replacement level, just like that of the United States. It's all about demographics. Women in Mexico no longer have 8 kids. They have their 1 or 2 kids, and the Mexican economy can absorb that type of stuff. So most of the people you see now are what folks at CBP affectionately called OTMs, other than Mexicans that come in the border down the south. That's now the majority of people coming across the border, a lot of them Central America, because of the situation down there. But because of the focus now on undocumented immigrants, you would think we're in the middle of a locust plague, and that's simply not the case. Most people are settled here. Lots of undocumented immigrants live in their own house that they're purchasing. They have jobs they've worked in for a decade or 2 decades. They have kids in school here in the United States. They pay taxes like everybody else. This is a problem we can fix if we didn't keep throwing words like amnesty something evil. Forgiving people becomes evil. What we need to do is just focus on the future, how we're going to fix our immigration going forward, and then just deal with the past and be done with it.
So, Jim, we all know that last year the president unilaterally ended the DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and then said he wanted Congress to solve the problem. They went through an exercise in which the president seemed to support a new DACA
measure. For about 12 hours, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that fell apart entirely. So now today, given that there's been no action at the White House or on the Hill, we're in an interesting place where a number of Republicans with a few Democratic allies are pushing a discharge position to insist that Speaker Ryan bring to the floor a DACA bill, among other measures, that would finally do some real work in addressing the problems.
Yeah, the politics are very interesting in this. You've got about 24, I think they were at 24 the last time I checked. They need one more to work with all the Democrats to force a bill to the floor that would fix the DACA thing. In fact, this fight that we had over the farm bill was a result of this particular fight, because the Freedom Caucus, the conservative wing of the House, wants their own bill. They want their own legislation. But you had this was maybe 10 days ago now. You had Kevin McCarthy at one of these closed door meetings with the Republican caucus. McCarthy is one of those seeking to replace Paul Ryan as House Speaker, and basically what he told the caucus is, you touch this issue, you change this issue, and you lose your Republican base, and we can lose the House. It's this interesting balancing act, because the discharge petition is being pushed by House Republicans who could be hurt if Republicans don't touch immigration.
Yeah, you're talking, Loretta. Galloway brings up an important point in why this is such an interesting issue right now. The Republican incumbents who are pushing this are primarily in districts where they could be vulnerable to Democratic challenges. So they believe they've got to pass some form of DACA to win the votes of people in those states that are likely to vote for those who support the thing. And the question then becomes, though, how does that affect the Republicans who are in deep red states and how they respond to all of this? They have to make a political calculation, too.
Well, I think it's kind of a complex scenario, and that those that are putting forward this DACA proposal are in states where there are changing demographics, and that's why their districts are more moderate districts by and large, and why they want this issue addressed. So you have a majority of Republicans and Democrats in some of those districts that want to see the DACA issue addressed. And so from their perspective, they're trying to move this ball along. Whether it's enough to just get a vote on it, whether it succeeds or doesn't succeed, or whether it ends up in the Senate where it may not get support, just may not be enough for those candidates to actually come out on top in November. The Freedom Caucus, on the other hand, which wants funding for the border wall in addition to DACA. So if there's a DACA fix, there's going to be border wall funding from their perspective. You know, they're going to vote how they want to vote. I mean, I think we saw that with the farm bill. And so they will be safe with their district because they will remain, by and large, authentic to what their positions are. So they're gonna hold the hard line as they've demonstrated on enforcement of the border and reforming legal immigration.
So in a way, Chuck, what I'm hearing Loretta say and Jim starting to allude to, it feels like this is kind of, this may be a no-win situation for a lot of these folks. If it's not enough for an incumbent in a district that's shifting in its demographics to just say she or he supports it if it doesn't pass, that's not going to get them reelected. And the red state incumbents all stick together. Who knows where something like this would go if it even makes it to the floor?
Now, I think it's clear they're going to have a vote. I think that's going to happen. They'll get one more Republican. There's four or five still out there that are kind of just waiting to be that last person to trigger it. They also lack three Democrats. Three Democrats have not yet signed on, but I think all of them eventually will. But let's talk about what this bill really is. What they're really voting on is a path to residency status for DACA kids plus the wall. That is in one bill. So this is $30 billion for the wall in return for green cards for 800,000 kids who grew up in America, graduated from our high schools, or are serving in our military. That seems like a fair trade-off, but the president has said that's not enough. I want you to also eliminate family-based immigration. And that's why the Goodlatte bill, which is the conservative bill coming from the Freedom Caucus, will die. It simply doesn't have the votes to pass. But here's the actual political reality. The Senate will not pass any of these bills. McConnell's already said he's not going to bring it up for a vote. Trump says he will veto anything that doesn't include eliminating family-based immigration. I've been telling my clients for the last year, look, they were not going to have an immigration bill. It's just simply not going to happen until after 2021 at the earliest.
So, Jim,
if I can interrupt, what's the situation with DACA, the DACA program itself in the courts?
Yeah, that's a great question. The oral argument in the Ninth Circuit, which is the circuit where the judge reinstated DACA for kids who had it. So if you didn't have it, you couldn't get it. But if you had it, you could renew. So any one of the 800,000 kids today that have DACA can renew that DACA for 2 years from whatever that approval date is. So DACA is going to be around until 2020, at least for some of these kids. Here's a couple interesting factoids. Only about 18% of the DACA kids have renewed.
Ooh.
So think about that. Only 80, that kid, they all can renew, and only 18%
have. What does that mean?
That's fear. That's fear speaking. I'm afraid if I renew, you'll know where I am. I'm afraid to go back. Then the other issue becomes, what else is going on? Well, Texas sued the president several weeks ago to declare DACA unconstitutional. And coincidentally, they ended up in the same judge, in the same courtroom, that stopped Obama from proceeding with the DAPA program. Now, DACA is different. DACA was done differently. DAPA was deferred action for parents. Basically, if your kid had a kid born here, we gave you a work permit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that Obama just didn't follow the rules. That was correctly done. But they got in front of the same exact judge, Judge Hannon. That oral argument is in July 21st. The Ninth Circuit's oral argument is June 22nd. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be, these decisions are going to come out at about the same time. The Ninth Circuit may say, DACA stays good until you follow the Administrative Procedures Act. I mean, let's be clear. Trump could end this tomorrow. All he has to do is publish a notice in the Federal Register. 60 days later, DACA's over.
So, Loretta, it seems to me there are two ideas, let's call them that for the time being, because they're not on the floor. There are two ideas that are traveling almost simultaneously in the Republican-controlled House as the midyear election continues to move forward. One of them is about whether or not there should be a vote on DACA. And the other is on a Trump proposal that he's worried that Republicans gave away the store when they passed the budget, put so much spending in the bill, and now they're talking about a major clawback, some $15 billion. But in both cases, there are leaders of the Republican Party who are saying, stay away from both of them. It's not helping us to—we can't win when you address either of them. Does that make sense? I'm not saying you agree, but there's a very similar theme going through those two.
Right. Well, I think for those representatives that are at risk and that are moving this forward, their sentiment is, as has been reported, is that, look, it's a lose-lose proposition almost for us at this point. So the thing to do is to do the right thing. And they feel that by their districts pushing DACA, a vote on DACA, is the right thing to do. And so it is a quagmire, and it goes district by district. Yeah. So it's very hard as a party to come down on this. And so by not having a vote, they were trying to push off. But it is an issue. I mean, we've seen immigration here on the forefront, on the Republican side, as an issue. And so it will have a trickle-down effect in the election cycle. It will not just be the national races. It will trickle down into the state races. And then you open a Pandora's box there as well.
But, so, Jim, I don't see any Georgia Republican incumbents who are under fire over whether there's a DACA bill or not. And maybe I'm just not reading the signs correctly.
Oh, no. The only one who might be under some, I haven't heard him say anything, is Rob Woodall in the 7th District. Rob Woodall, and maybe Karen Handel, but so far they've been towing the line.
Well, Woodall particularly, because he's in exactly the kind of district you've talked about, Loretta, a changing demographic.
He has a hugely changing demographic in his district, and we saw that particularly on the Democratic side of the ticket, where you had 6 candidates, very diverse set of candidates. And I think you even have in the runoff, both of them were born and raised in this country, but one is of Asian descent. And so,
This is David Kim.
David Kim, mm-hmm. Right. Even though he was born and raised here in the States, he does have that background. And so, it could come up in that race, but that's still, again, a national race by and large.
Yeah.
So we're looking at governor's races where the issue, because what happens at the national level gets permeated at the state level. And so then you have all these gubernatorial races that then have to jockey and deal with whatever's coming out of Washington. So it becomes very fluid.
Well, both Woodall and Handel have endorsed the Freedom Caucus bill, the Good Lad bill.
Okay.
They're both on that bill, so they're both in the minority of where you're going to move
forward. And that's the equivalent of the Purdue Cotton bill in the Senate.
Yes, well, not quite as bad, and they're trying to ameliorate it a little bit more. But again, there's zero chance that we'll move forward.
Jim, let's take up another issue around immigration that's really surfaced in the last few weeks, and that is a policy that ICE is apparently now following to separate, at least in some cases, children from their parents when they're detained at the border. I'm not even specifically sure how formal that policy is or if it's a guideline that the Trump administration...
It's a Trump administration policy that began, I think, several months ago, and you've had Chief of Staff John Kelly talk about it as a disincentive for people coming in to claim amnesty. And Jeff Sessions,
asylum, thank you.
Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, has said much the same thing, that if you come and claim amnesty asylum at the U.S. border, you're going to lose your children.
Yeah, Chuck. Is this an official, is this just a directive that some people are being asked to carry? Is it the official policy of the United States government through its law enforcement, ICE and others, to do this? Or is this something that's being planted in the heads of these guys?
Oh, no. This is official policy from the Attorney General of the United States, because it stems from the new policy. We will prosecute everybody who doesn't cross at a border crossing.
Which
means they separate the families.
Oh, you have to separate
because you're
the
putting
family.
You could do what Obama did. You could put people in jails with their parents, with their moms at least. There's several of those facilities, including one in Dilley, Texas. But their policy is separate them out, deter people from coming. And so far, their policy is wildly not working, because you have to choose from being temporarily at least separated from your child or having your child murdered and raped. I think I'm going to go with the separation from my child.
Are you dealing with any clients?
We have a number of clients who have subsequently been released after they pled guilty to the federal misdemeanor, served their 2 days in jail, then released. They have been reunited with their children. but that we know of several who have not yet been reunited with their children. I don't know where they are.
Loretta, the president has said that's the problem. That's a problem Democrats created. He has said he's tweeted that it's Democrats who passed the law that separates families the way that is happening right now. True? False? Is there a law that came through Congress on this?
Not to my knowledge.
No.
Not to mine either, by the way. Kind of an expert on it.
Not to my knowledge. But no, I think that was, you know, a campaign rhetoric trying to push his agenda. I'm not clear about what the end game is on that strategy. It's a little bit convoluted. And unfortunately, what it does is it really it makes the president almost contradict his policy. You know, by saying that what Democrats are doing is wrong, then this policy that Chuck has spoken to that comes from the Attorney General's office, you know, is essentially Donald Trump's, which then would make it wrong also. So it's a very end around way. And, you know,
you're telling us that his tweets on this might become evidence.
I mean, in every piece of litigation, his tweets have been evidence.
Right. And so I mean, at the end of the day, I'm not sure what the strategy is, and there probably isn't a strategy there around that. And so it's sort of an ad hoc political rhetoric that I don't think is going to effectively work for Republicans. And I think you're seeing a lot of pushback from even Republicans on that.
Go ahead. No, I'm sorry. Jim, you get the last word on this before we have to take a break.
Well, all I would say, I defer to the two Republicans in the room here on this.
Well, then I'll reserve the right to make it. It's this. I believe that the president sends out a tweet like that because he recognizes that this is not a popular policy among Americans. How you know? So of course he wants to shift responsibility for this. So Cindy Simpson, by the way, is watching us on Facebook Live, and she says, spending that kind of money on the wall, speaking of the $20 billion you mentioned, Chuck.
$30 billion.
Seriously, anybody who votes for that after this tax cut should lose their seat, period. Thank you for that, Cindy. You're listening to Political Rewind. We got to get a break in. We'll be right back.
Happy World Oceans Month. I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, we'll meet the seafaring scientists hunting new species and mapping the depths. Plus, a tropical depression greets the Great Lakes. Is that a sign of things to come? Your hurricane forecast on this, the first day of the hurricane season. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
3 o'clock this afternoon on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Watch us live on Facebook Live, the GPB news page. Tweet us at PoliticsGPB. You could, if you're watching, you could, as I turn to Jim Galloway, watch how he responds on camera.
And here I am, just folding my arms in defense.
Pensively.
So let's talk now about the tariffs that the president kind of surprised everyone by suddenly announcing yesterday, 25% on steel imported from our allies, Mexico and Canada.
And the European Union.
And the EU as well, but, you know, particularly our neighbors to the north and south. And then 10% on aluminum. And although this is a huge national issue, and there's going to be plenty of commentary about it across the country, this has some direct and important impacts right here in Georgia, as it will elsewhere.
Oh, yeah. You've got innumerable businesses who take that steel in grades that you can't get made in the U.S. at this point. And they use them to make things. There's a second issue, of course, that underlies this, and that at the same time, the Trump tariffs were going into effect at 12:01, I think, this morning, maybe. I think so. You had some very, very definite rumors coming up that another tariff is going to be imposed on luxury import cars into the United States.
We're going to talk about that in just a minute, because that has a potentially major impact on the state of Georgia, beyond perhaps even what the aluminum and steel tariffs do. Stephen Fowler, who is Ricky Bevington's, if you listen to All Things Considered in Atlanta, you hear Ricky host that show. Stephen is her producer. Stephen, you talked to Senator Johnny Isaacson yesterday. You went to talk to him about the new Veterans Administration bill, which is important, and we're going to get to that on another show. But because it's in the news today, you also talked to him about his feelings on these new tariffs.
That's right. So getting Johnny Isaacson to sit down and talk about the VA was one thing, but then he opened it up to questions for everyone afterwards, and that opens up a whole can of worms. Somebody asked him what he thought about the tariffs and about what he's talked to the president about, and he told us the same thing. He said he told the president in the executive office 3 weeks ago that he's concerned about the tariffs and the impact it has on Georgia, and we have a audio
we listen?
Of him. Yeah, we have him talking about one thing in particular he says should hurt.
Let's listen.
Coca-Cola Company, which is headquarters, world headquarters in Georgia, they use a ton of rolled aluminum for cans and steel. That's a component part of one of the biggest products that's sold in our state. When you raise the and if the material cost of aluminum is 25% of the cost of a can, and I don't know if it is or isn't, but if it's 25% of the cost of a can, then it's a 25% increase in the cost of the component part that goes into that can. That's the cost to the consumer, and it's a cost to the producer, and it's difficult.
Stephen, was he pressed at all on his feelings about the president in terms of making this decision?
So it's funny. He says, Johnny Isaacson says, the president is the best negotiator around and the best deal maker. And some of the best deals that he's made, the president's made, and Johnny Isaacson's made is where they've put something out and then walked away from the table before the deal is done. So he said with these tariffs, he's hoping this is kind of a bluff and kind of a way of saying, if you don't do this, this is going to happen. But he's hoping that the president doesn't go through with a lot of these tariffs and a lot of these things for very long, because there's impact on Georgia as well as the rest of the country.
Steve, tell me if he touched on this. There's another issue with a tariff issue involving Canada, where we have slapped tariffs on newsprint coming into the United States. And it's going to hit very, very hard in June and July, and you could actually see some small newspapers across Georgia close shop because of that. Isaacson has pushed some legislation forward on that, but it seems to me with this with this escalation of tariffs on steel and aluminum that particular issue could get a whole lot complicated and could get lost.
So he didn't mention the newspaper industry specifically. He was asked about the steel and the aluminum, but he did mention that many of the tariffs, whether it's steel or newspaper or anything like that, that he really hoped and that he communicated to the president and everyone that it didn't impact the United States and hardworking Georgians negatively. And so he's hoping that things get resolved sooner rather than later.
You know, Loretta, it's interesting because now Senator Isaacson says he talked to the president about tariffs a while back when the president first started talking about tariffs on steel and aluminum. His junior partner in the United States Senate, David Perdue, says that he went to the president and said, don't do this. And now Karen Handel, who has not parted ways with the president publicly on anything, issued a relatively cautious statement and, kind of like Isaacson, criticized the policy without criticizing the president.
And her statement was directed toward the car imports. Correct?
Didn't touch the car imports. It was about
it
the,
was the tariffs.
Oh, it was the tariffs.
It was the steel and aluminum.
Okay, I hadn't seen that. Yes. Well, I think you're seeing a lot of Republicans break on this. There's a lot of concern. And what we're seeing in the press is you saw the Treasury Secretary come out one day and say, you know, we're going to put a hold on these conversations. You've got Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, supposedly going to China today from another meeting. And then you've got his internal communications teams, like Larry Kudlow, right? Kudlow is his economic advisor. And they're all in their own little silos. So there's no process, apparently, within the White House for these conversations happening. And heretofore, it had been a process whereby there was a process that somebody was leading who is no longer in the White House, where the secretaries were being able to give input, and there were regular meetings so that all of the members of the administration were on the same page. And right now we're seeing a kind of an ad hoc policy with regard to tariffs.
Yeah, and you've got this terrific debate building, and it could have an impact in November over whether the Republican Party is a free trade party or whether it's a protectionist party.
You know, Chuck, it's great that Loretta mentioned the different voices coming out of the way. Larry Kudlow actually told reporters, I think it was just this morning, this isn't a tariff. This is a negotiation.
When you think about it, is this how you negotiate, put outrageously crazy positions on the table and then back them up and say you won? That's what we're seeing across the board in a lot of different issues. Or does Trump have a building he needs to build or a resort in Europe so he wants to get money from them like he did in Indonesia? Who knows what's going on, but it's clear there's no real process. It's just whatever the president wakes up in the morning and thinks should be a good idea that day.
Stephen, did anyone ask Johnny Isaacson whether he feels that this is, and I recognize that anybody could ask any question, but I'd be interested in knowing whether Senator Isaacson thinks, what he thinks about his constituents in Georgia and whether they favor protectionist policies because they believe in what the president says, that it'll help create jobs here. Or are they worried about these things?
Well, what he did mention is that his first priority is obviously seeing what the president says and how this plays out. But he did say that he doesn't want industries to be forced to move outside of Georgia and outside of the Southeast. He mentioned the textile industry as an example of a lost opportunity with the way things have gone. And so he doesn't want to see the automakers or things. I mean, Coca-Cola is not going to leave Atlanta. But what he doesn't want to see is tariffs to be imposed and the people working in the automobile factories and Coke and places like that lose their jobs or have higher costs because of these tariffs.
I am glad that he mentioned the automobile industry because now, Mr. Galloway, we
All
need
right,
to talk Mercedes-Benz and Porsche.
All right. Okay. So you've got Mercedes-Benz, which just opened its USA headquarters in March in Sandy Springs. I mean, that was the formal opening. Mm-hmm. 3 years ago, you had Porsche move its North American headquarters to that little spot right outside of Hartsfield-Jackson, where you've got the little test track going. And so we've got the two probably best-selling luxury car headquarters in the United States, right here in Atlanta. And you've got and yesterday there was a report floated by a German business magazine that quoted Emmanuel. The president of France, help me here.
Macron.
Thank you, Macron. It said, Macron visited Trump in April, and Trump told him that he is going to slap a tax on luxury imports and is not going to lift it until the last Mercedes-Benz disappears from Fifth Avenue in New York. That is pretty stark.
Loretta, what's going on here? I mean, here's the thing about
this. Gosh, I wish I knew.
I think somebody has an issue with Berkman, but
So you've got steel and aluminum tariffs, which are supposed to help American jobs. And there is a report that you will grow maybe 150,000 jobs, but the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says, yeah, but it potentially loses 2 million. You've got steel and aluminum with auto manufacturing. It travels back and forth across the border. Mm-hmm. I mean,
the same car goes back and forth across the border.
The same car goes across the border. And then you're going to eliminate all automobile import. It's hard to understand. Again, you said this policy, you didn't use the word, but there's this chaos about the way policies are being set, established in the White House. It is hard to understand the president's thinking about how this helps make us safer and better.
Well, right, because he's doing it under the auspices of the National Security Act. And I think that was an issue that the Canadian Prime Minister raised was about that. How is this jeopardized national security? We've seen some U.S. senators come out and just call it plain dumb. Literally, that was a text from Ben Sasse today. This is just dumb. I don't think you're going to see Republicans going along with this for very long. But I think the economic impact to Georgia can be significant, in particular the Southeast, because when you look at the fact that not only do we have the corporate headquarters here, but we have manufacturing facilities for Mercedes-Benz in Alabama and South Carolina. We have Volkswagen in Tennessee. We try to recruit. We have Kia here in Georgia, and there are a lot of jobs associated with that manufacturer. We have Caterpillar. There are many, many jobs associated with the Caterpillar plants, and our ports love the business. And so it's not good policy for the Southeast, particularly on the car front. And so I suspect that idea is going to get some real resistance from the Southeastern members of Congress.
On this program, Bill, we have kind of been skeptical when it comes to the vulnerability of Karen Handel in the 6th District mm-hmm. congressional race. Mm-hmm. But this issue is something that could actually lose Republicans that seat.
Yeah, well, that's one
absolutely.
Of the reasons
I agree. I live in the 6th, and particularly depending on who gets that Democratic nomination. If it's Kevin Abel, I mean, he comes from a business background. He's run businesses. He goes after Karen Handel on this every day, every single day. And there's a lot of Mercedes executives that live in that district and whose families live there and their friends live there. The industries that support Mercedes, this could be a nightmare for Handel.
By the way, time for a little history lesson. Jim, one of the things about Ben Sasse's tweet this morning that was actually rather funny was not only did he call the policy dumb, but at the end of it he said, make America great again does not mean make America 1929 again. Referring, of course, to the fact that there are many people who believe that the trade war that President Hoover started had a direct impact on the depression that began shortly
after
those policies were put in place.
Debating that point ever since.
Tell you what, why don't we get another break out of the way? Stephen Fowler, thank you so much for being with us today.
Glad I wore my Facebook shirt today.
Before we go to break, you've been making some great comments for us on Facebook Live. And Jose Perez takes everyone in this room to task except for you, Chuck Cook. Cool. He says the only one who talked about what is good for the country and its people is the lawyer. All the politicians and journalists there will only discuss whether this or that wins or loses votes. This is why our democracy is such a failure. I understand why you'd come to that conclusion, but I also think that we made it clear that we think that the separating of families at the border is seems to be not among the best of American values, but your point is taken. Jacob Burney says, have the tariffs and rhetoric from the White House hurt our credibility and our good standing with others in the world? Because I hear that Germany and Britain and Canada are all upset. It feels like a shakeup for shakeup's sake at the cost of the public. So before I go to break, yes, President Trudeau of Canada has already said he is rather outraged that the United States would say that Canada is a national security threat.
Macron has called it illegal.
The World Trade Organization is looking at taking up a case against the United States, right?
As they should. I mean, this is, I think, is illegal. I think it violates international law. And it is just dumb.
All right. Thank you for those comments. There are more. You know, even if we don't read your comment on the air, you ought to either watch us or join us at PoliticsGPB on Twitter and see the conversation that's unfolding, and you can join it there. Let's take our break and come back in just a minute.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR, and thanks.
We're back on Rewind. Loretta Lepore, Chuck Cook, and Jim Galloway in the studio with me. One quick comment before the governor's race. You'll all be interested in knowing that as we sat here talking immigration, the Washington Post just moved this story. Illegal border crossings remained high in May despite Trump's crackdown, and the lead is the number of migrants attempting to cross illegally into the United States remained high in May, according to Border Patrol agents, an early indication that zero tolerance measures separating parents from their children have not been an immediate deterrent. But you said it's seasonal.
It's seasonal. Plus, the reality is you have to choose. Will my child get raped or killed, or do we get temporarily separated from in the United States where they'll be safe? This is a no-brainer for most people.
Okay.
The other thing people don't realize, the migrants, as they're walking across Mexico, aren't checking their Facebook feeds every day to see what the policy is.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that in terms of the deterrence piece, how is that news getting back to the countries?
Oh, it's all over the press in Latin America.
Okay.
So I was in Colombia last week. It's all over the press. Everybody knows about it.
And Gerber sends us a message on Facebook Live. I called Isaacson's office today to let him know how I felt the tariffs were bad for the U.S. They said his statement was that he believes it's bad for Georgia. So, Ann, thank you for letting us know that the Isaacson office is carrying through the message that Stephen Fowler reported to us about. Jim Galloway, the other day, we played an ad, Casey Cagle's first TV spot since the runoff began, and it was a very lovely, very gentle, positive spot. His wife talking about what a fine Christian gentleman her husband
it
has
was,
been.
It was an ad in which Casey Cagle told us how he wants us to feel about him.
Right. So we said, isn't that lovely? A positive, upbeat campaign. They're starting off with a message of defining who he is. They're not going to start attacking Brian Kemp yet. And then this happened.
So, Mr. Kemp, you want my vote?
I sure do.
Well, why'd you default on $700,000 worth of loans you personally guaranteed for a grain processor?
Why'd
you refuse to pay farmers millions of dollars you owed them for their crops? And why'd the state suspend your license from doing business with farmers?
Shame
on you, Brian Kemp. Get off my porch.
Brian Kemp, incompetent, untrustworthy.
Okay, so I really should have set up the visuals for you. I apologize.
It's a great visual.
What we've got is he doesn't even look like Kemp, an actor who is.
He's got
dark hair and he's got a white shirt on.
All right. Okay. It's an actor playing Kemp sitting next to a farmer. It's
on a
rural
front porch.
The farmer's got a shotgun.
A double barrel. And it's very similar to the one that Brian Kemp pointed at Jake, the suitor in that primary ad of his.
So, Jim, the gloves are off.
Yeah, and the shotguns are out. This is a very, very deliberate, very quick effort to undercut Kemp's trying to portray himself as a kind of an outsider-ish businessman who knows how the world works. And the lawsuits are real. I think the Kemp people have told us that there was a $700,000 gap in one complaint that's been bargained down to $200,000 and settled, and there's another one that needs work. It's all about a canola processing plant in Kentucky in which Kemp was a major investor in 2014 or so.
While he was Secretary of State.
While he was Secretary of State.
Loretta, actually, what's interesting is that in writing this story for the Political Insider, Jim points out it seemed pretty clear the Kemp folks figured this was coming because they were ready with answers to these accusations. That's smart politics.
Yes, and they've had to answer them before because they were reported previously. And so they're pulling from, the Cagle campaign was pulling from old news clips and so Brian Kemp has had to respond to this in the past, and so they were ready there. That's part of good opposition. You got to figure out where your opposition is going to be coming from. The gloves were off on primary night. We knew this was not going to be a pleasant runoff, and it likely will not be.
There's no secret Russian dossier, is there, on Kemp? I'm just curious what other bad stuff might be out there. They're both going to sling a lot of mud over the next few weeks here.
Well, it's interesting. After the show went off the air, on Wednesday, I said to Greg Bluestein, who is, of course, on our Wednesday show, I said, gee, the Kemp people are quiet right now. We've seen the first ad in the Cagle campaign. Why isn't Brian Kemp out there? And Jim, he pointed out something important. He reminded me that Karen Handel, after, she went dark for quite a long time, while the Democrats were fighting out their candidate. She didn't feel the need to get on right away, and so maybe Brian Kemp can afford to be quiet. We don't have a primary until July, a runoff till July 24th.
But again, any time that you cede the field, you're allowing your opponent to define you. And that's exactly, it's pretty clear that Casey Cagle thinks he's going to have access to better finance, campaign financing than Brian Kemp. Simply because he's on TV. He's already on TV with two spots right now.
What would you be doing, Loretta, if you were running the Kemp campaign? Would you be up as soon as possible?
I think so. But again, you know, to Jim's point, it comes down to financing. And so, you know, I haven't seen where Brian netted out at the end of the primary. But it's not as though he's not out there. He is out there and he is campaigning, and we see that, and he's running. We had this conversation offline about they have an aggressive social media campaign going. They're targeting their demographics. The other thing is, you know, that what we don't know is, will there be any kind of pivot? Will Brian, the Kemp team, be making any kind of pivot in the runoff? You know, he did throw some things out right away on primary night and attacking, you know, Casey Cagle, but maybe they're not going to run that kind of campaign in the runoff. We'll have to see. So obviously he didn't have anything in the bag ready to go or that he wants to release yet. So there's probably some strategic thinking behind that.
Chuck, I find it hard to imagine that Brian Kemp, we're not going to hear Brian Kemp once again at some point say, and yes, I just said that. Yeah, I mean, that worked pretty successfully.
It worked before. I think he'll work it again. They're both playing for a very small electorate in the middle of July. I mean, reality is, who's going to vote in the middle of July? So you're talking very few thousands of people that will be going out. So they have to not only reach those people, they have to motivate them to come out on a hot Tuesday in the middle of the summertime.
All right, we're going to watch how that unfolds.
Yeah, and it wouldn't surprise me at all right now if we're nine days off the primary now. If Brian Kemp has spent a whole lot of his time in a room with no windows and one telephone, making phone calls to his friends, trying to raise the cash.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was on the road this morning in Dairy Queen making calls. So we posted that to his Twitter account or Facebook account. So,
well, you know, I've got more recent news than you do. He was at Dunkin' Donuts for National Donut Day.
But that is a very legitimate point, because you have you have all the folks that supported the other candidates in the primary,
and they're trying to get them on
and
board.
And these candidates, you know, both the Cagle camp and the Kemp camp, are going after those voters, and that requires a phone call.
Right.
That requires some real courting, because people, you know, they feel badly that their person didn't win. And you know, you got to massage those people into helping them understand why they need to pick you second.
Well, and many of them were anti-Cagle people. I mean, they didn't go for Cagle because they wanted another choice. And so I think Kemp's got an easier time attracting some of those folks if you could reach them with a message that doesn't move other people away from it.
All right. Well, we've got weeks to talk about both the Republican and the Democratic race. Jim, I want to do something very quickly, and I'll give each of you a chance to respond. And I do this because the other day, we, like a lot of news organizations around the country, spent time talking about Roseanne Barr's bigoted, racist comments about Valerie Jarrett. No sooner do we get through with that than Samantha Bee makes incredibly crude and vulgar remarks about Ivanka Trump. And, you know, I was talking to our producer, Tom Faust, about how much time do you want to spend on this sort of thing? The dialogue, we know the dialogue. We know things are getting to the lowest common denominator. Mm-hmm. It's getting worse and worse. But, Jim, is it all right if I just say, in some ways, this is all just awful white noise? And maybe not talking about it makes more sense than spending too much time talking about it.
White noise is an interesting phrase.
That was Tom Faust.
Yeah. I would just say, just everybody grow up a little bit. Just a little bit.
Take a breath.
You know, Loretta, I'll bet you do the same with your children. You know, the excuse is, well, Donald Trump coarsened the dialogue. It's his fault that we're getting to these levels. And I bet we tell our kids the same thing, which is, wait, you're you. Doesn't matter what the other person does. You have to be the best of who you are. And so this excuse that Trump started it is probably true. But so what?
Yes, and you know, and thankfully our kids are not watching Samantha Bee and some of these other folks,
because other people,
it would be a little hard to explain. But what I find really is with some of the younger kids is that they have less of a tolerance for this kind of rhetoric. They don't necessarily associate it with Donald Trump. They just have a different way of thinking. So when you look at millennials on down, they, you know, when you just look at how they vote, when you look at how what matters to them, when they're much more global in their focus. They're much more accepting across all kinds of demographic boundaries. This kind of stuff repels them. You know, they, you know, when I watch some of the younger people watch ads, some of even the ads that came up in our gubernatorial race, it was like, there's no need for that. Like, there's just no need for that. Why can't we talk about this in a civilized way? Why can't we? And so, you know, really, I think it's probably idealistic for me in a lot of respects, but I am hopeful that those generations that are coming up are the ones that are going to really affect some change in this regard. And they have the ability by being able to cast votes and to make change in these elections. And so, you know, I've personally found Samantha Bee's comments to be repugnant. I thought they were so far over the line. And I thought the distortion of Ivanka Trump having a photograph with her son was just totally and completely uncalled for. Not everything in our world is political. Yeah. Not everything is political.
All right. Chuck, what it does also do, this white noise, it takes our eye off some of the important things. Oh, so, for instance, Jose Perez, who just sent us a note saying he thought we were missing a big point about being human rather than political. He said, what about the 4,000 deaths in Puerto Rico from Maria?
Yeah,
we take our eye off things like that because we're focused on this stuff.
Things, our fellow human beings, our fellow U.S. citizens, at the cost of just making these stupid, silly comments that have no impact on anything other than to insult somebody else. We need to be focusing on policy to truly make people's lives better.
As we, by the way, AP just moved a bulletin that the North Korea summit is back on. So,
go to Singapore.
Go to Singapore, and you know, it strikes me is that you have two world leaders now, who have the same emphasis. The emphasis is get the photo, and worry about the details later.
Laura Adams just sent us a Facebook post. She says she has an idea for what she calls a great bumper sticker. It would read, everybody grow up. Laura Adams.
That's a good point.
Maybe we could go into business together, Laura Adams. We're just about out of time for today's Political Rewind. Jim, one very quick note. We talk about a changing world, maybe a world that learns to be more accepting and caring about people who are different than we are. You had a wonderful story that you posted online today about the first Bangladeshi immigrant Muslim elected to the legislature. Take 20 seconds to tell us about him.
Sheikh Rahman won Senate District 5, beating Kirk Thompson in a Democratic primary, 68% of the vote. He is, we think, the very first and only Muslim in the state legislature. Certainly he's the only Bangladeshi.
Yes. The world, there is change in the wind,
there is,
Chuck
there
Cook.
Is. And that's the Democrats that have done that in their own primary. And Kurt has been a senator for 16 years. It's good to see change. Change is good. It moves us forward. It brings new people into the political environment and gives us new solutions.
All right. We are basically out of time. I'm looking. We have a couple of Twitter comments. I don't think I'm going to have time to get to them, unfortunately, because I have to first say goodbye to Loretta Lepore. Thank you for being here on Friday again, Loretta.
Pleasure to be here.
Chuck Cook, come back more often.
Always
we like
a joy.
Having you on The Immigration yeah. Man in Lawyer in Georgia. And, of course, Jim Galloway, I'm going to see you back here again on Monday. And for people who don't get to watch the show or listen to the show on the radio, you can always listen to it on our website. And you can watch it on Facebook Live. Thank you, Jim. Have a good weekend.
You too.
All right, everybody. We'll see you again on Monday at 2:00.